Bob, randomness, also known as contingency, is a perennial topic for avant-gardes, but I think I found the key to it, which is that if you accept randomness into anything you're doing, if you look to the side of your computer screen and read the Collins Road Atlas of Europe or Please Don't Jog, you find more interesting stuff to consider than if you keep staring dead centre of your computer screen according to what you've looked up that's really interesting according to your friends. Now, you are a McLuhan scholar of huge proportions. Does that relate to anything in McLuhan? Does that relate to anything? Because in a way we want to chuck out the sandbags, don't we, of Karl Marx and Marshall McLuhan and James Joyce and these figures that have drawn us together and Frank Zappa. We want to cast them out and go up in a hot air balloon. But does that ring a bell for you around anything in your experience or your reading?
It is the key statement in understanding media. Well into the book, I don't remember the exact page number, McLuhan says, now that we're in a TV environment, you can only write books by grabbing information at random.
Hmm.
Now, how's that?
Well, that's how I read it, but I mean, probably, you see, I always feel slightly less utopian than, I mean, you always tell me, well, it's satirical, and Marshall doesn't really, he always disagrees with what he's describing, but he's been taken up in a way, I mean, I'm thinking of that Wired magazine, in a way that's very positive, and it used to be the various quotes from him were like the flags of the cyber boosting movement, which has now died and collapsed and disappeared. But there's still this utopian thing, and I always want to get it back to a more realistic appraisal of what TV's doing to me. And I would say, well, anything at random from all this nonsense surrounding us is because it's all saying one thing and it's pretty limited, and it's the kind of cage I want to break out of. That's why I can take anything at random from it, because it's all saying the same thing to me again and again and again.
Yes, the content may be saying the same thing within each culture, but the form has a universal effect. One size fits all.
Well, we're all in it.
The tactile effect of television is a form.
We're all in it, and we can. Does this include getting drunk or stoned or just teenagely excited with staying up late and staring at the analog dots on your TV screen?
Yeah, McLuhan always added the proviso that if you're drunk, try to study the effects of it.
Mm. Well, this
you always
actually
recommend
is
studying the effects of whatever you were perceptually engaged in.
This is a very Benjaminian point. I mean, Walter Benjamin isn't somebody that we talk about a lot on this show, but he wrote his, what are they called? He wrote about marijuana. He wrote about experiments with marijuana. And I've developed, I mean, slightly helped by Frank Zappa, but also out of my own experience, that I find druggy people a drag. I don't like them. I find them boring. So I'm sort of pretty anti-drug. But the Walter Benjamin approach, which is to say, well, I'm going to take this thing and then really think about what it's doing to me, that seems very attractive. You know, that's fine. You know, that's kind of like interesting. And this seems, McLuhan's comment seems in that vein.
It is exactly. I want to mention, when he says one writes books at random, you don't watch what's on TV. You need to span the sources of information, newspapers, radio, books, whatever, and find information to create a random collage. That is the only way you begin to present the reality of what's going on to every one of us, which is exactly what Joyce did. He wrote his books in the Finnegan East style, and you could say that about Zappa, but I wouldn't. Zappa was disciplined in what he selected, but he did allow chaos and randomness to happen.
Certainly. I mean, I'd take you up on the point that James Joyce isn't disciplined, in the sense that discipline is very misunderstood because of our general culture. We take discipline to be a thing imposed upon us from outside. But the original idea of education, of disciplines, of learning, is of drawing you out, of developing you, and it coming from yourself. And for me, and this is looking at For example, Eugene Schadbourne said to the drummer of Lendomin, Cristiano Luciani, when they played together in Rome recently, "The thing is to break the rules." And Cristiano loved this idea. And these musicians, when they're saying that to each other, are absolutely correct. I'm also aware that these musicians can break all the rules because they have an internal consistency and discipline with their instrument, which makes their breaking the rules absolutely fantastic. But I mean, you can get some sort of, and there are many of them in the avant scene, amusical dorks thinking they're breaking the rules, and they're actually just creating this horrible narcissistic mess, and I really dislike it. I mean, breaking the rules is fine if you've got an exuberant, expansive, isomplastic process going in on you, which is honest and relating to everybody around you and sensitive to everything, then breaking the rules is absolutely necessary. But the mere breaking the rules and the pretense of breaking the rules has kind of become the absolute, you know, boring norm in all media.
Yeah, and the point about studying the effects, Zappa, you break the rules, but you study the effects of breaking the rules on your musicians, on the audience, and on society and the products you create. That's the difference. If you just break the rules, that's nothing, but you have to study the effects of it.
Absolutely. The breaking the rules is interesting because of what happens. And this is actually a situationist argument you're coming up with, Bob, because it's the creation of situations which is where modern art should get to. That creating objects for sale is a ridiculous commercial enterprise that people think that's art and that's just this little game that a few people engage in. But creating situations where you say, let us observe this phenomenon, which is, I think, is that Frank on Roxy and Elsewhere? He's got all these dancers up on stage and there's all this kind of chaos happening. He says, let us observe this phenomenon. That idea of you've created the chaos and now you're interested to see what will happen next actually draws you into the realm of science, because you are being properly experimental. I mean, that term is thrown around generally. It means a noisy mess that normal people wouldn't want to listen to. But experimental in the true sense should mean you create a situation where you don't know what's going to happen, and it's interesting to you to observe what will happen.
Dr. Zircon's secret lab. The way art becomes scientific and one up science is turn the environment into a lab, not a puny little genetic engineering lab or psychology lab. You turn the world into a lab.
I like your use of environment there. I've just been reading poetry by Ian Paterson. I mean, you were talking about him earlier, actually, off mic, weren't you? I hope that would ring round to something that would ring a bell with the audience. I realize. Anyway, I was reading poetry by a Cambridge poet that you visited when you came to England, and you had interesting discussions with him about Wyndham Lewis, and I really liked parts of it, and other parts I was wincing because I was feeling that Ian was locked in appreciating poetry and wanting to recreate what's in poetry, and I want him to improvise with his environment, not merely with the poetry he's already read. And I think that means interacting with his environment.
Yes, and when I was with Ian, I showed him Marshall McLuhan's review of Wyndham Lewis's Nova Express and Naked Lunch.
Hang on, Bob, I've got to stop you there. Those books were not written by Wyndham Lewis, they were written by William Burroughs.
Oh, sorry, that's what I meant. I showed him...
But I love it, I love it. Bob, I've got to tell you why I love that mistake. Why your mistake is...
appropriate.
Well, why it twangs me, baby. Because I find when I'm writing and I'm really thinking that the writers who I am congruencing in my argument become indistinguishable, and I say sometimes Zappa, or was that Marx? I can't remember. But they're both getting so materialist here and so anti-bourgeois and so funny that I swap one from the other. Now, the pedants around us come and say, hey, you said the wrong name, you're wrong, you don't know what you're talking about. But to the creative person, to the person who's really producing a new idea out of their sources, this swapping of our particular enthusiasms and forgetting which one it actually was it Wyndham Lewis or William Burroughs? I mean, they're very phonemes I'm saying begin to sound the same. And William Burroughs, William Lewis, I mean, if you say them with enthusiasm, they almost sound like the same thing, is better, because we've reached the point at which they've flown into us, so that we are saying what we've been influenced by them. By the way, I'm using my hands to focus this energy, and then they're going to whiz past the ears of my computer screen, and that's the point. That's thinking, that's merging two things that weren't merged before. So these things that the pedants say are errors, and why academia gets so constricted and confused and entangled and can't move on, is because it won't allow that naming the correct name at various points is not the point. That we should fuse these things into a general argument. And your argument, I completely agree with, in the sense that Naked Lunch is the book that Wyndham Lewis should have written. I think William Burroughs actually leapt over various hurdles that were holding Wyndham Lewis back. But that line, your mistake, actually proves the incredible accuracy of your literary taste.
That's right, because I was explaining to Patterson, who's an expert on Lewis, on Wyndham Lewis, how McLuhan took certain things from Lewis and how Lewis anticipated Burroughs. This is what I was telling him. So you're right. And what happened is, it was McLuhan made 11 notes. It was published in The Nation magazine in December 64. You can look it up. Or it's even on the internet. We'll go to William Burroughs' reality studio site or something. It's there. He's enumerating the difference between James Joyce, Wyndham Lewis, and William Burroughs, and also himself embedded in there, in their studying media effects. And he talks about how Lewis, he sees Burroughs picking more up from Joyce than Lewis. Anyways, the key point in the interview, or in this art review that Ian was struck by, that I recall, was how McLuhan said, today we retrieve Egyptian art methods. We turn the whole world, the whole environment, into an art form. And he said, and McLuhan said, that's what Burroughs was doing, Lewis was doing, and Joyce was doing. And it's definitely what Zappa was doing. Intercontinental absurdities.
And this somersault with where you think things are, this operation on ordinary life that these radical artists are doing, is, I mean, I always feel like I'm telling you about my headache and you're joyous. But I mean, it's, you know, I live in a deprived part of London. You live in a paradise in the Pacific, you know. So maybe that reflects it and maybe helps us have good conversations. But I feel that the all these... I'm losing my thread, Bob. You've got to put me back on the rails.
Okay, just the laboratory. I forgot to say that McLuhan talks about Burroughs using the whole world, as a laboratory. That's what we're talking about.
And this turning it round. So instead of producing the artwork we're all looking at, you look outside the artwork at the world we're in and realize it's made by humans. That this, everything has been placed by somebody once. That you live in a house, but every brick was put there by some grumpy or happy person, and the cement and the powder and the cement came from somewhere, and you start to understand the reality of what we're in, that the art argument becomes, the mere obsession with art becomes this kind of embarrassing adolescent phase that people go through, and James Joyce's Ulysses kind of made that very graphic. It starts off with Stephen Dedalus, who's a rather uptight, oversensitive aesthete, and the whole point of the book is his meeting Leopold Bloom, who's a kind of a middle-aged advertising canvasser with a kind of sporadic education, and Stephen getting more mature because he hangs out with him all night and begins to understand what life really is. And that's the you started with the intensity of art, and you don't really want to lose that, because that's the analytical, eager edge. But the real thing is to start looking at the complete world that humans have made and realize everything is an artifact around you. And this is more true since the industrial world than it was, say, in the Middle Ages, where there was a lot of, like, unbroken nature out there. And this unbroken nature, there's less and less of it to find if you can find it. So that we can read the environment like a book, because it's all been put there by somebody, which is why the poet Bob Cobbing used to start off his graphic poems by walking out into the street and finding a piece of litter and taking it and putting it on the photocopier he had in his house, and he'd blow it out and work with it and produce some extraordinary things which look like nothing that modern art in Tate Modern has come up with. And that is the method, reading the randomness of the urban detritus around you.
Yeah, and McLuhan felt this was a retrieval of medieval sensibility. You have interest in medieval sensibility. The medievals...
Oh, this is weird,
symbolist.
Bob.
Everything was studied as an effect.
I'm finding this very weird, because when I wrote my book on Frank Zappa, there's an introduction that talks about exactly that. That now the medieval world picture is true. That when somebody in the Middle Ages picked up a walnut and said, when I crack it open, this looks like a brain. Walnuts must be good for your brains. I think that is mystical hocus pocus. You look at a walnut, it looks like a brain. Why should it be good for your brain? I mean, you know, it's just insane, really, when you think about it, you know, scientifically and so on. You know, it's a nice homeopathic, right on kind of symbolistical load of nonsense. But now, when you look out your window and you see a hoarding and it's saying something, when you look out your window and there's a plastic bag flying on a tree, you are, when you read those things, when you read what's around you, it has all been put there by people. It is part of a discussion that's going on, which you can disagree with or interpret, or it's part of your communicative world. So because of what industrial society has done to us, that medieval idea suddenly becomes true.
Exactly. And remember, the medieval trope was the book of nature along with the book of scripture. So I'm saying that McLuhan pointed out that we were in the 20th century naturally moving towards, in our art, arts for effect, not the product, and not trying to have the audience like your product. You want to see how they respond to the effect of the product. Obviously, serializing work in progress in transition in the 20s and 30s was Joyce's lab, and he was studying the effects, and he was watching these idiots, Eugene Jolas, and them get all excited and call it the revolution of the word and all this.
Yeah.
They had no clue what Joyce was doing. They got stuck in the content, and he was studying the effect on them of what he did.
Well, I have more time for the revolution of the word bunch than you, Bob. I think Transition magazine, which published Finnegan's Wake as it appeared, did collect together some of the best writers. I mean, in France, they have a beautiful word for what I want to tell you, which is provenance. Once when I was in Paris, somebody said, "Quelle est votre provenance?" to me. And what he meant was, where'd you come from in thinking? You know, where'd you start? It's not saying, like, where'd you come from racially or economically or anything like that. It's like, what's the basis of what you're talking about these days? You know, it's a very French, intellectual, nice thing to ask somebody. And my provenance comes from J.H. Prynne in Cambridge. And J.H. Prynne, his whole thing came from Oxford English Dictionary, Donald Davy, certain amount of traditional Thomas Hardy English literature, but he read Transition. Now, he wasn't a Joycean. In fact, he's very critical of Joyce, but he read Transition, and his whole education that I had from him in literature was about that magazine. Now, there's a fantastic book about Transition by Doug. Can you remember? Anyway, there's a book about it, and I've read a few issues. I've gone to the library, read quite a lot of it. I bought one issue. I don't normally buy antique collectible volumes. In fact, I think it was Esther who bought it. Anyway, and reading that, looking at the people that appeared, you know, they printed photographs of collages by Kurt Schwitters. They had contributions of poetry by Hart Crane, and these were all people who signed the manifesto of the revolution of the word. So I wouldn't diss the circles around Joyce, and particularly when you think about Samuel Beckett's essay on Finnegan's Wake in the book about Finnegan's Wake, Our Examination Round His Factification for Incamination of Work in Progress, which is for me one of the crucial pieces of argument about where society and politics and art are. All that came out of Finnegan's Wake. I think to say Finnegan's Wake is just there, it's the John the Baptist waiting for the Jesus of Marshall McLuhan, that's all there is putting it a little bit, you know, wrong. I mean, you know, we should be interested in those people who wrote for Transition and the Revolution of the World and the Revolution of the World Manifesto in itself. And that line from the editors about, please contribute to this magazine. We are not frightened of texts we don't understand. In fact, we're only worried that we'll understand them all too well. I mean, editors talking like that is magic, Bob, don't you think?
It's okay if you're a writer, but the revolution brought in by Joyce, Lewis, and Zapp and McLuhan was they were not limited to the medium they used.
Well, none of us should be limited by any medium.
Let me finish a bit. You go on for 5 minutes. Let me just say a little bit.
All right. Okay. Oh, a little bit. Okay.
I know you're excited and you love talking to me, but I'm too patient probably. Let me just say...
Come back.
A side thing. McLuhan... He talked about writing books at random, but he wasn't limiting himself to being a writer. He was using any medium at random to study the effects on himself and other people and on the environment. Zappa was not a musician. He studied the effects of someone pretending they were a musician on musicians as well as the public. Joyce was not writing literature with Finnegan's Wake. He was taking the whole exercise of writing a book and pretending he was an author and studying the effects of someone who wasn't limited to that. That's what the transition people miss. They were writers. You're a writer, Ben. You're addicted to that one medium.
I think you're limited to that. I think you're right. And in my own...
I have no problem with that, but that, in terms of understanding what's going on, that's the criticism.
No, that's really interesting. I mean, I'm still working this out, Bob. I'm debating it in my head because I suppose I'm talking about my provenance and, you know, comes from studying English literature, but I got this little glimpse of something a bit more exciting from Prynne, and he pointed me towards Transition. And so you're looking at Transition as closing down the revolution Joyce started back into literature, whereas I'm talking about the fact that it was injected into literature means it can explode again somewhere else. Because I sat through Prynne's his lectures, in which he just gave everybody a poem and started talking about them, and his method was to look up every word in the Oxford English Dictionary and tell us about the materialist history of where the words came from. It was all about Frank Zappa. I sat there in the lectures going, but it's all about Frank Zappa. Now, I've been considered out to lunch and mad ever since because of this response that I had. Now, one way of working it out would be via your way of saying, yes, I got this new media response that was in Finnegan's Wake. It was slightly in the transition people, and I was getting it back to where it belonged, which was responding to media. Or you could say that I was responding to understanding the big social movements of the 60s, which masses of people did, which all these people we talk about are mere tokens of, Marshall McLuhan, Frank Zappa, you know, these names that we say. The real stuff is what everybody did in that period of turbulence. And that may be what I really want to get to in talking to you, is that all this cultural guff we talk about, and, you know, which poet do you like best, and all this culture, is in fact just froth on a big ocean wave, and it's that of people doing things and conflicting and disagreeing. We're just looking, you know, art's just a symptom of what's happening socially. And it's that social possibilities in the 60s I still adhere to. And this comes back to our last program where I felt slightly I was the old lefty under attack from the postmodernist explaining that I was old fashioned. Is that I don't want to go back to the 60s. Who can go back to the 60s? But there was something that happened with people then that changed things, which is really required now, amplified.
Yeah, that's right. I think of the 60s as the flowering, the supernova of the chemical body. And what what's Minerva's owl leaves when the culture is finally having its greatest flourishing. That's when Minerva's owl shows up.
That's great. You know, when you really understand something, you can misquote it and it still sounds good, you know?
That's right.
It's the owl of Minerva flies at twilight, which is wisdom comes afterwards. Well, it's a kind of depressing thing when Hegel said that. He's saying that only when everything's over can you understand it. I mean, I disagree with it. I quote back at that, Goethe, saying, theory is grey, but the tree of life springs always green.
No, good. So let me, I'm just saying that the supernova...
Sorry, you know, when, the golden, when started, while we're being this pedantic, the golden tree of life springs always green.
Good, good. So, you know, the cliche about the star exploding, and it's most brilliant at the end, it's called a supernova. Humanity, the chemical body, expressed great freedom and movement and turbulence and excitement because it was the supernova of the chemical body. And why the bland out happened in the 70s and then this weird situation we're in is that we were moving into a new discarnate body, electrified body that Lewis and Burroughs and McLuhan and Joyce predicted and wrote about.
Well, that's not how I fit it into my world picture of history, Bob. I part company with you completely at this point. I just don't see it like that. Why not see it the other way? Which is something exploded which hasn't yet even been tried.
Well, the media, the Android meme, what I call the Android meme, the shrinking of the media environments is making the 60 sensibility come back. The chemical body can see that the media environment is shrinking around it, but we're not limited to the chemical body. So any of the major movements and revolutions of the 60s are now happening tenfold. There's way more sexual revolution in the 60s, way more drug revolution, way more everything, media consumption, riotous anarchy, totalitarian Nixons. There's more than ever was.
That's the I can kind of, in a certain way, but why am I dissatisfied with the spread of that stuff? Why don't I like it, Bob? What? Why is it I'm not? I don't look at the huge success of Oasis and think, yeah, a kind of grubby rock band has got there and everybody likes it and we've won, which is what people around them and, you know, not unintelligent promoters and semi-politicized people thought about the success of the, where are they from? I can't remember, Manchester, Liverpool, somewhere up north. You know, the success of that band. They felt, why, can you explain to me why I sat there going, I mean, it's not because it's on TV. I mean, because, you know, Frank Zappa played a bicycle on TV, and that's how he got on TV, and playing a bicycle is a great thing to do. I was playing a bicycle with my 40-month-old Mordecai today at a playgroup, and playing a bicycle is just fantastic, you know, hitting it and getting the sounds. And TV can... be the first time you see the Beatles, which produced an explosion in America. I mean, white kids think they can play black music. You know, that TV is not necessarily, like, always a bad, you know, transmission belt. Sometimes things flash through that medium. But what... Well, I'm asking you to explain something, which, you know, I got my own explanation sort of wanted to come out. But why is it that this version of the 60s that's happening all around us is leaving me dissatisfied?
I think it was George the First said to Gibbon, who's doing the rise and what was the history of the Roman Empire, whatever it was titled, the decline and fall, and he said, yeah, scribble, scribble, scribble. You're a note-taker, Ben. Your very training as a writer incapacitates you for the 21st century.
The 21st century is a literary concept, Bob.
Okay, good.
It's so literary, it creaks, you know. I mean,
well, did you hear what I said? I got to use literary concepts when I talk with you.
Oh, you can use anything you like, baby. I mean, you're a disembodied voice. You're as electronic as you like. No, I was hoping for a bit more sympathy from you on asking you to explain it.
Look, Ben,
but
I'm
getting no sympathy.
I'm a writer, too. I have sympathy for you, but I'm telling you why.
No, but I'm not getting any sympathy on this point. I'm getting absolutely nil sympathy. I'm just getting insults.
Well, getting insults. You asked me why. I didn't know you wanted sympathy. I'm telling you why.
No, but this is the reason I need to talk so much on this show, because only if I am given the the peace pipe, you know, the thing that you hold that allows you to speak in a meeting, you know, if you give me
the microphone, the
rhythm stick, you know, the flag, the thing that the babies cry for, you know, I gotta have this, gotta have that, and then, you know, and then they drop it as soon as everybody loses an interest in it, you know. The reason I've gotta have that is because I can explain I can explain to you what you would like to articulate. You know, I can actually help you see. And what I'm saying is, it's the creation of a machinery that produces something else which is serial and boring, that the reason why Oasis is not satisfying is you can see the trick being played. And a point J.H. Prynne made to me about revivals was, things come round again, he said, echoing, obviously, George Clinton and saying that everything comes around. But there's always something missing, he said. Now, I find that very interesting. There's always something missing. And there is something missing from the current turbulence. And, you know, it's not the 60s again. There is something missing. And what is missing is a global contestation with capitalism itself. That in 68 you had, in Paris, a seizure of a capital city in a leading country by workers and students who sent telegrams to China saying, and we don't like your system either. I mean, you know, they weren't saying, oh, the communists are wrong. They said, you know, this state capitalism in China's rubbish. Why don't you do something over there? I mean, that's what's missing. You know, what produces the imagery and the self-indulgences and the drugs and the, you know, this and that. But the actual sense of a global contestation of the system we're in is not there. What we have is, the only global consciousness we have is something being led by all the powers that be telling us to tighten our belts because of the ecosystem.
The homogeneity of the global culture of the 60s that you're looking for is the afterimage of the literate sensibility. You have a homogeneous
culture.
It's not
a homogeneity.
Only when you have literacy.
Bob, I can't say that word because I don't agree with it. There is nothing that's homogeneous. Everything is contradictory. Everything is split. I'm talking about a contestation. I'm talking about a confrontation, a split.
Yeah,
you're
confronting something from with a point of view which is enhanced by literacy, and you're looking at one enemy. We've demobilized consciousness, decentralized the enemies. Everybody's your enemy now and your friend, and you can't tell the difference. It was simpler back then, and you're hankering for the simple enemy that literacy created.
This is complete madness, Bob. You are mad.
Well, I'm here to be the mad one, since
you're
so sane.
Yeah. Well, literacy does not create the point of view I'm expressing. That where does your new education in media get you in terms of analysis? You see, that's what I don't understand. I mean, you can prance around within radio or the internet or, you know, be a person, but where does that allow you to actually understand anything more than anyone else? I mean, you know, you're a drunk at a bar.
Well, I'm here to have fun, Ben.
I was having fun,
but I don't limit it to literary analysis. I study the effects of my drinking in the bar.
You see, let's have some house rules for our discussion. That saying I'm literary, whereas you are somehow got wings, is simply an insult and not fair. Because most of what you're talking about, James Joyce, Marshall McLuhan, was written in books. You wouldn't be able to say these things without media, without a thorough education from books. So, I mean, you know, why have you got wings and I'm simply the stunted literature person? I mean, you know, I mean, if you were Elton John, you know, I couldn't answer you. You know, you are reaching millions of people. And, you know, I mean, how could I say that Elton John, you know, from my literary socialist point of view, you're wrong? You know, if he's reaching millions of people, I mean, you can't do it. I mean, you've got to invent punk rock or something to get rid of Elton John. You've got to do it a different way. And you seem to not credit the Marxist left with having relations to things which are not literary. I mean, strikes are not literary.
Talk about you, Ben. You asked about you.
Well,
there's the McLuhan aphorism, user is the content. You're stressing your own relationship to media and content around you, and you're dissatisfied or finding something empty. I would suggest that you find it incomplete because you try to translate the electronic tactile orgy into a literary analysis. You limit it to the left hemisphere, to writing.
This is really cheap, Bob, because I don't believe if you sat with me watching an Oasis video, you wouldn't want to say the same things that I'm saying.
But
you have a dissatisfaction with the multiplication of the 60s paraphernalia round media, and I think it's actually a Marxist analysis of who gets hurt and who's actually being exploited, that all this stuff hasn't solved basic inequalities and exploitation. I think that's what drives you, actually, that underneath all this blur of newness and new electronic bodies and whatever that is. I mean, nerves have always been electronic anyway, you know, back into the animals. I mean, how could it be new? You're driven actually by a left critique. That's actually what you want, and that's why if you and me went to an Oasis concert, we'd point out exactly the same things, you know. The band right over there, the tiny dots on the end, you know, everybody's getting drunk and they're just dropping litter everywhere, and then the immediate environment they're in, they're not paying attention to, and they're involved in this sentimental idea of these awful songs which make them feel big in their hearts, but their brains are hurting because there's nothing there. You know, we'd be at one, you know, we would be uncomfortable in exactly the same way, and you're producing this sort of attack on me, and I'm hurt, you know, because I felt I was articulating your dissatisfaction with the way the 60s has influenced the global media. Are you really happy with it?
I studied the effects of what's going on. If I went to the Oasis concert, I'd be able to see what you're seeing. Yes, I'd see that, but I would not limit my seeing to that. I'd push and see what things I wasn't seeing. I'd push my perception.
Well, but one of the effects, and are you statistical about it? I mean, does it require thousands of people to be affected before you're interested? I mean, are you some agent of marketing analysis, or are you interested in the effects on one particular person, namely me? Or is that irrelevant? No, but you're telling me I'm irrelevant. You're saying, well, you're literary, you haven't got up to speed with the new epoch that we're in. And these epochs are completely conceptual, literary ideas, you know, which epoch we're in. I mean, it's the whole con of postmodernism, isn't it? Well, there's this watershed after 1973, everything's different, you know. And we're being run by people telling you, well, you're blocked in history, it goes up to here, that goes to there, and it's just like academics telling you, well, we can't do that in this discipline. You know, it's just a time-based business of disinforming everybody about their connection with what they think is true and right. And I think we should have the ability to sit back and look relaxedly at things and try and articulate these little uncomfortable tickles we have in our brains to see if someone else is feeling that way.
Well, if anybody's wondering why I don't get to say much, it's because I'm studying the effects of what Ben says on me and on himself. And I try to come in and when I get a chance to comment on the effectual exchange here. How are you being affected so far? What are the effects so far of our interaction today?
No, can't say anything in that area. I mean, I'm breathing a little harder, I suppose, because I got kind of a little bit annoyed with you. But
that happens every week.
My heart
rate high, and then you get low.
My heart rate's up, you know, which is good. But I'm, you know, is the ideal to be an automaton with a regular robotic heartbeat that doesn't feel any passions? I mean, you know, this is like talking to some, I want to use a word we can't use on air, but, you know, some professor in a seminar, you know, who's cooler than I am, and I'm the young student, you know, and you're saying, well, you know, you're patronizing me, Bob, so I don't like it.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry it appears that way, but I don't get much chance to say anything, so I'm just noticing your patterns as you speak, and I'm trying to explain to you why the interpretation of what I mean by your literate bias or literate limitation is not an insult. It is a technical statement. It's a preference you have.
Well, you see, Bob, I don't think it's true.
Bob, what the heck is analysis?
Bob, I don't think it's true. I mean, I don't think my analysis is straight out of literature. I mean, I think it's musical. I mean, I'm musically based. I'm arguing about the truth of music as a communication to the body, which challenges your concepts. That's what I'm interested in. So this literary thing is a red herring, you know, it's a diversion. It's not true about where I'm coming from. So it's kind of annoying to get, you know, stamped with that. And this strict demarcation of the literary and then these patterns you have from Marshall McLuhan, these little boxes where you've put everything. I mean, I've read your diagram, you know, are holding you back because you're not able to really talk to me and work out what we think about. Let's choose any object which we can discuss aesthetically. You know, I'm quite prepared to have a discussion about anything we both respond to. That's fine. But I get these, you know, you are over this line and this line, and these lines I don't even know or agree with, you know, that have been laid down in the sand by Marshall McLuhan. I mean, I don't care about them. They're not... So I mean anything.
Ben, you're the one talking a lot, and you then said, let's figure out why you aren't.
But I'm talking because I'm talking because if I was so literary, why am I talking? I mean, I'm talking as a body responding to you, as a musician might respond to someone else. And if I've got a solo, I've got a solo. You know, this is free jazz, man. I don't think it's literature.
Well, good, and I'm just doing John Cage's 432.
Well, that's pretty bad, you know.
What, the silence?
Yeah, it's kind of, because I wanted to get back to this, because, you know, we kick-started this discussion with, I was thinking about Evil Dick, so I was thinking about his thesis on randomness and contingency and what's on the side of the computer, and, you know, we began talking like that. And I had in my mind that one of the things, one of the wrong ways of interpreting what randomness could be is John Cage and chance, because I think John Cage has been the primary ideologist of the belief systems of the liberal bourgeoisie in the United States, that all the people who've parroted back his kooky Zen-based ideas have produced nothing in music, and that John Cage is a It's in fact understanding that and revolting against John Cage, which is going to be the next wave of any music actually being able to be realized in the first world. And absolutely. I mean, Zappa is the absolute enemy of Cage, because Cage said, if you're non-motivated, you're better. Whereas Zappa always wanted, however febrile and stupid the expression from his musicians, he wanted absolute, you know, you're embedded in your instrument. What's the word? You inhabit what you're playing. He never wanted this dispersal of interest, of, you know, this Zen-like transcendence of the individual. And, you know, he wanted individual expression. And I mean, that's why we're talking, isn't it? I mean, we're talking about these ideas over agreeing about the oeuvre of Frank Zappa. So that's true.
No,
but you
that.
Were then, Bob, quoting John Cage as something which, you know, you seem to be agreeing with, or, you know, seem to be an ally.
You make a mistake. If I quote something, doesn't mean I agree with it. I just said I'm like John Cage 432 in terms of being silenced. It was a humorous remark.
It's kind of irritating the way you come back to Marshall McLuhan's escape clause for all the stupid things he said by saying, oh, well, if I talk about something a lot, it probably means I disagree with it. That's not quite true. If you talk about something a lot, you think it's important to talk about.
No,
it is. Why talk about it? I mean, if you really disagree with something, why is this confusion? Why isn't it clear, you know, what Marshall McLuhan, where he stood? Why is it like, oh, some people took him all this way, some people took him all that way? I mean, I don't think that's a good basis for... I mean, it's a good basis for mining somebody for interesting ideas and quotes. It seems to me that Marshall McLuhan is the resurrection of John Ruskin. John Ruskin, who you can't read a page of without reading a contradiction, and yet is quite exciting and says quite perceptive things, but then he blows it up on the next page. That's Marshall McLuhan. He's the new John Ruskin. And I can see imaginatively...
Marshall was an expert on Ruskin, wrote a lot about him.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Confused people, they love each other.
Yeah, and Ruskin,
Bob, you are confused.
Ruskin.
You're confused, and you enable me to articulate. This is why I like talking to you. But I'm running out of gas.
I present confusion that you can correct.
Absolutely. You are the confusion in the minds of the average man that normally my criticisms don't get dealt with. Whereas with you, I can... Yeah, I think you're the average postmodern confused liberal with your ideas. But you laugh when I make my analyses and criticisms, whereas a lot of people get offended and walk away and stop the discussion. So at least we can keep talking
no,
for 55
minutes. I agree
with
everything you say. I include you. Now, what's funny is that even though I'm this postmodernist, lazy liberal, every now and then I say something, you go, that's right!
Exactly! Bob, I didn't actually say the word lazy, you know. You put that in yourself.
Okay, whatever it is. None of it's true.
Interesting.
None of it's true. Your label of me is not true. But anyways, the funny thing is, if I am an image of something that you're refuting, every now and then you have to go, I agree with you completely on that point, Bob.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I do. I mean, I'm talking about your fundamental tenets, which, of course, as an electronic person, you have no fundamental tenets and you're up in the ether. Yawn, yawn, Wired magazine 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
I am describing the effects of that.
Well... But
I'm describing the effects,
but I think there's a lack of dialectic in your release clause about you're describing the effects, because cause and effect are conceptual terms to separate two things. Are they really there in nature? Is there cause and effect? Well, I think probably not. That to stand and say, well, I'm talking about the effects, whereas you're talking about the cause, seems to me to take a stand on a very crude metaphysical distinction between two things, which don't ring true for how we're interacting and what's going on and what we're looking at. I don't think I'm only looking at poets and not at readers, or only looking at rock bands.
No, you want to take notes about them, though, what the other stuff you're looking at. You want to analyze them. You want to fit them into literary categories or some kind of category. You want to write something. And well, I include speech as part of the literary sensibility.
Well,
we don't live in a speech environment.
Bob, you're ignoring, you know, for the last 3 years, I've been primary child carer, and for the last 40 months for two children, and I haven't had a chance to write anything, or, you know, which is partly why I'm doing this, you know, that I have...
Yeah, you get time to do the other complementary of the literary activity, which is speaking. The content of writing is speech. Speech and writing go together. That's why on your show, when you talk about, you know, last year I gave you an impetus or an inspiration to go a little more verbal, messy verbal or something, and improvise on your show, you didn't recognize it's still within the literary sensibility.
Well, can you tell me where this other sensibility exists?
It's extreme sports. It's people watching anything, no matter what, like American Idol or whatever. Britain's Got Talent. It is Evil Dick making
all right.
You know, what's the other guy? James McDougal doing his work. There's everything that's going on is not literary or verbal. It's kinetic and tactile.
Yeah, I agree. But I think what you should say is drop the literary thing or the analytical thing. Yeah, I'm intellectual. I want to understand things. But isn't that what our discussion is? I mean, what could we do on this? You know, could we blow raspberries at each other? Well, we could be playing instruments to each other. That would be the constructive way of dealing with something that's non-verbal. But insofar as I'm talking to you, and this goes back a long way for me in discussions, that if we're going to talk, we're talking. And to say, well, we're just talking, there's a big world out there that you're not including, is the most crass, sophistical argument that's ever used in philosophy. You know, you might beat me in this argument, but it's just argument. And, you know, you're doing that. And I'm kind of sorry for you to be in this corner, really, which is, you know, it's a classical error in communication to go, well, I've lost the communication, but the communication's sour. It's sour grapes. It's all nonsense. Okay. I don't like it. You know, I'm going to go and do extreme sports now. I mean, you know, bomb. Go surfing. But, I mean, if you're going surfing, we're not talking, are we?
No.
I mean, so far as we talk, we're entering...
I'm trying to
drag you up by your bootstraps, but I mean, you're a slow burden, you know, you got some pretty regressive, dumb, you know, ideas in there. And one of them is, well, most of humanity is not doing what we're doing, so it must be stupid. No, they're all doing extreme sports. They're not all doing extreme sports. Extreme sports is just a one channel, you know? It's
drug taking is an extreme sport.
Well,
addiction is an extreme sport.
Well, yeah.
See, I collapsed the definitions on you.
Oh, now, well, that's hilarious.
I'm trying to be more literary than you. I'm trying to establish a matching here so we can launch a revolution and have the global confrontation.
Well,
so
how do we do it? Well, I thought it was me that was confrontational, whereas you were waking everybody up to the fact that it's the beach and the sun and seagulls and everything's lovely.
I am trying to wake people up onto how we confront and what we confront.
Well, I'm very keen to think about that.
Okay, let's start thinking about it. What are we confronting?
Boredom.
And Croker writes about the boredom culture.
Exactly. You see, I mentioned something I want to talk to you about, and immediately you have some guy who's written about it, which must mean it's cool. Just because Croker wrote about it, it actually means it's
boredom. You're talking to a guy who's not generally bored, but maybe I should be analyzed and take my body constituency, whatever I am, and apply it to everybody so they won't be bored. But go on about boredom. I said my part, now you say. We're trying to converge here.
Well, we were trying to say, what do we want to confront? And one of the things I want to confront is boredom.
Okay, I agree. How do we confront it? Got any ideas?
And I think boredom,
there's lots of stimulus apparently trying to assuage everybody's boredom, and you find most of that offered is boring.
Well, to fuse Marx and Freud, that boredom is a product of, Marx would say, powerlessness, and Freud would say sexual repression. And I think both of those things, because you talk about this new world where the 60s is one, where everybody's doing tons of sex. I think it's tons of sex which has a master, which has an economic exploitation built into it, which means it's not actually sex at all. It's a kind of the use of sex for an economic transaction. So the actual sex and the utopian release of love is not actually there. So
is there any orgy clubs in New York City? This woman would write a column for New York Press and describe every other week the orgy she had this week. Have you got any orgies, or is that not sexual liberation? Well, what kind of sex are you looking for?
Well, I'm looking for real intellectual discussion with you, which is the only kind of sex we can actually get to via this medium.
Because, that's good. Okay,
I think, you know, a real dialectical change in my ideas or in the listeners' ideas is all we can get through this quite dry system of piping words down Skype to each other for maybe broadcast here or maybe putting on archive.org. That's all we can have, and that's the high point of it. And to refer to all the other stuff that one might do is always this destroys what we're doing in favor of gazing and hoping about something else, which is what most media does. I mean, it's usually not about what's happening now, it's about what we could be doing, or someone else did, or that was exciting, or that's a rumor, or did you know that, you know. And I hate all that. I find it really boring, because I want this to be the high point of what can be achieved through these voices babbling in somebody's earphones. You know, that's where I want to get to, and I'm saying that it could be great. You know, the you're not a poor sucker listening to Bob and Ben show now, that actually we can get to a vision of how things are working, and this is what you were dissing as analysis and merely literary and, you know, kind of irrelevant. For me, that's what we can do, and it's all we can do, Bob, and you've got to admit that.
Well, I like your definition of sex as including, you know, other sensory interaction. That's good. You're not taking sex literally, or the you're not attaching the image of sex, and even as it's marketed, to what you mean by sex. That's good. We're on the same page about that. I've always considered myself very sexy. And yet you don't see me having much sex with anybody. It's not being photographed or splayed about, but I'm very sexy in the way I interact with people on the telephone.
Well, of course you are, Bob. Yeah, I wouldn't have dialogues with somebody who wasn't sexy. I mean, who do you take me for?
All right, so how do we get some sex here?
Take me for some dried-up dog biscuit?
What'd you say?
Do you take me for some dried-up dog biscuit?
No. I'm just trying to figure out how we have some more sex here.
I think you need to read some more Hegel. That's how we could get more dialectical sex.
I need more sex.
Yeah. Hegel's never been considered literature in England, I tell you. It's the enemy.
Here I am trying to stay convergent.
Now, one of my advantages on this show, Bob, is that I have my eye on the time and it's up. Goodbye, Bob.
Okay, great.